This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Joshua Clover, Associate Professor of English Lit and Critical Theory at UC Davis. He's also a poet whose work has three times at least been selected in the Best American Poetry of the Year series. Last year, he came out with a big book entitled 1989, Bob Dylan Didn't Have This to Sing About. Joshua Clover, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's neat to meet you and to go over this topic and others that come up. Why did you choose this focus this year, 1989, and focus everything on that?
I think there's several answers. The book makes an argument that in 1989 there were really substantial changes that happened in pop music. And when I say pop, I should stress that I mean really pop, music that sold vast amounts. And there were extraordinary changes. We saw the birth of grunge. People argue about the exact date, but really I think it's 1989. We saw the birth of acid house or rave culture in the UK. And hip-hop, which was clearly on its way to global domination, made its huge shift from a sort of black power, black nationalist version we identify with Public Enemy and so on, to what we call gangster rap, right, which we identify with N.W.A. and Dr. Dre and so on. So that's the sort of logical answer, is it seemed like just a lot was changing in that year. But there's, you know, there's also a personal answer. I remember the time, and I remember being very engaged in the music. I was living in the Midwest in Iowa.
What were you doing there?
I was in grad school there.
Okay.
And so it was my first time sort of living in the center of the country, and flyover land is, as people often say, and
you're killing me with that.
My access to the world was, you know, was only through the newspapers and through television. And so there was two things I saw all the time, which was videos and MTV, which I was very fascinated with. I still would be if they still played videos. And then this sort of sequence of astonishing political events in Eastern Europe and other places in the world. But in some way, they seem both the same, right? It's just these sort of televised spectacles at this infinite distance that are amazing to look at, but they're all in that same, you know, 20-inch color box in my living room. And so I started thinking about those two things, this interesting musical changes and that historical moment together. And years later, I decided it was probably worth trying to make a book out of it.
It's interesting, you talk about the construction of the concept of 1989, and one of the themes running through the book is, why do we focus or simplify in the way that we do, so that 1989 means only one thing? And in the common political memory, 1989 means the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it doesn't mean, as you go into some detail, Joshua Clover, Tiananmen Square. In fact, Tiananmen Square doesn't mean Tiananmen Square. So how do these meanings become distilled? Who does the distilling? What is that process?
Yeah, I wish there was a guy we could just find. It's great to find the guy to blame, you know, like the Bernie Madoff story. Somehow the financial crisis was... So yeah, Bernie Madoff distills these images. No, it's a huge cultural operation, right? I mean, everyone does a little bit of it every time that someone says the syllables 1989 and they mean one specific thing. And it comes to just stand for this instant we see on television, the wall's breached, people are flowing through, and we sort of have this knowledge of what's going to happen next. They're gonna buy chocolate and blue jeans, and there's going to be a bunch of revolutions with funny names. But it sort of gets down to this single instant, this image. People really like to focus on the single image, so that even Tiananmen survives only as that one image of that, you know, Tank Man, as he was famously called in Time magazine.
And what's wrong with a Tank Man image? You have a discussion in there that was novel to me. It might be my own ignorance of contemporary Chinese history, but it really wasn't one man against the communist system.
No, the Tank Man image, it's a spectacular image. I don't want to take away its power, but in some way, it really does a lot of work for certain people, and that it poses the lone individual, the heroic individual, against, you know, the nameless, blank, impersonal system that was communism, where you don't even see any communists. We just see tanks And there's this guy, and he's not just a guy, it turns out, he's a shopper, which is a huge punchline. He's actually carrying shopping bags. So he really stands for, you know, the heroic individual shopper, the perfect American, except he happens to be Chinese, right? And standing up against the blank anti-shopping of communism. And so you can see how that image, which should tell us a lot about China, which has a fascinating and complex political history that I barely grasp, but it does tells us far less about that historical moment, which is very complicated, and far more about an American preference to believe certain narratives or certain ideological projections.
And part of the revolt against the Chinese government in 1989, you point out in your book, was against the free marketization of China. So that cuts in totally 180 degrees from the common perception of that one man against the tank.
Once you start reading Chinese intellectuals' accounts of that moment, of the May 4th movement, of Tiananmen Square, of the history of the recent history of China, you come to understand that there's pressure both ways. There certainly are many, many people who are opposed to the communist system and the ways it has imposed itself on the people. But there's also many people who are very dissatisfied with what are called the roaders, the members of the Communist Party in China who've decided to follow the capitalist road, and which has led to increasing wealth disparity, right, and lack of social the standard things you recognize, lack of social protection, increasing marketization of various things, various kinds of instability, and people who are really opposed to that and would rather go with the pursuit of a more equitable version of communism, achievable or not. So there's pressure coming from both sides in that moment, and of course we prefer to only recall a specific sector of that struggle which is conducive to our own ideas.
And it was the idea that Fukuyama made famous with his end of history comment in 1989 or 1990, and you play off that a lot, and you examine it in detail rather than just dismiss it out of hand, but it's such a silly comment. It was such a silly comment at the time, and it eludes so many, wipes out so many things.
The first thing one could say about it, you know, he famously said that we'd reached the end of history, the final triumph of liberal democratic capitalism, that there was no imagination of any kind of opposition to this anymore. And it's easy to dismiss this as wishful thinking. Like, wouldn't it be pretty to think so if you were one of the privileged of liberal democratic capitalism? Of course you'd like to think that was going to obtain for the rest of time. So one of the things we can identify it is a wish from a particular sector that would like to believe in their own sort of permanent ubiquitous omnipotence, which would surely turn out to not be the case at all. But I think there's actually more to it than that. I really do want to take it seriously, which is if we imagine him to be saying not that history has ended, but that our capacity to think historically has ended, to imagine history in its complexity as an unfolding sequence of dynamics and changes. He's kind of right. I mean, we had, I'm not sure who the we is, like the Western intelligentsia, I'm not quite sure, right? But we had, in many ways, extinguished our capacity to think complex historical change at that time. So he's indexing something that's real in the world, but not what really happened, that's for sure.
And also, as you point out, Joshua Clover, in this book, 1989, Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about. We'll talk about music soon, I hope. But I've been leading you down the political path because that's what I know better. So, you know, what he completely denies is the continuity of what Marx would call the class struggle.
Indeed. And that's I would say that's the main thing, that's the great suppressed of recent historical thought, and that's what I try and get to in the book, even when I'm talking about the music. You know, my account of those musical changes is that in different ways, because of course hip-hop is quite different from grunge, is quite different from acid house, but in different ways they try and track or register or understand or get their heads or sounds or guitars around this thing that suddenly vanished, which is this historical antagonism, which we could think of as the USSR versus the US, or the East versus the West, or communism versus capitalism, but maybe the earth-ematic, right, is still a class struggle, the dispossessed and exploited versus the possessed, for lack of a better term. And the sense that this had vanished or that we were supposed to believe in it had vanished, and that antagonism was sort of magically wished away. That's the sensibility or the feeling or the delusion that I try and track over the course of the book.
And you say pop music has taken Fukuyama at his word, or you call it pop Fukuyama for short. And but that's such a sweeping generalization. There must be some people, even who rise to the level of mass appeal, who are counter this kind of hegemonic view.
Well, maybe so. Maybe you should tell me who they are. The thing that most interests me, so the most Fukuyaman moment in pop is one of the signal songs of that time, which is the song Right Here, Right Now by Jesus Jones. Although, as I always like to note, at that time of their extreme fame, the lead singer, Mike Edwards, insisted they be called Jesus Jones. Their song Right Here, Right Now, which is specifically about the fall of the wall, and has no comment on it. It's just, no place on earth I'd rather be. And he has that phrase, watching the world wake up from history, which is clearly a profoundly Fukuyaman phrase. Really, it probably dates back to this passage from James Joyce, where Joyce is sort of glossing Hegel, not to throw too many names around, where he says, nightmare is a history from which we cannot awaken. And that's clearly present when Jesus Jones, we think of them as like dopey pop guys from Britain. They're cute and they wear funny hats and they have bad dances. But they read books, clearly. They think about things, clearly. And so what I'm interested in is not that he wanted to offer a counter-narrative, but that he knew what he was saying, they knew what they were talking about. They understood this was a historical drama that went back to Hegel. They weren't just sort of dopes speaking dopily. And I think that's important to remember.
And they have in that song the line Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about, which is the subtitle of your book, 1989, Joshua Clover. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Let's talk about Dylan a little bit. In that song, you say it's obvious they're putting Dylan down, of course, and also you mentioned Tracy Chapman and Prince that are referred to in the song, and I wonder if you think they're right in that put down, because somewhere in the book you say that, they were criticizing these singers for empty analysis or empty representation and opinion.
I don't think they're right, but I'm not unsympathetic. I remember about the third time I heard the song when I realized that in the verses, where mostly they're not naming names, it starts, a woman on a radio talks about revolution, but it's already passed her by. And after a couple listens, I realized they were referring to the Tracy Chapman song from the year before called Talking About a Revolution. And I admit, when that Tracy Chapman song came out, I didn't much care for it. It seemed like a kind of liberal posturing. I didn't believe she really wanted a revolution. I didn't believe she understood what a revolution would entail. And I take those matters very seriously, I must say. So I was sympathetic to it. But the idea, right, is that of the song is that all that posturing, it gets blown away, evaporated in the heat of the actual political moment, when all we should do is sit there and experience it wonderingly, right here, right now, just being in the moment. And I don't buy that either. Like, I think that when one finds oneself in particularly charged or intense or volatile political moments, one picks a side and gets down to business. That's a bad metaphor. One picks a side and figures out what to pursue. One doesn't just sit there and go, "Wow, man."
It was the power of coincidence is what they were celebrating more than anything, it sounds like, by what you're saying and by reading the book. But Dylan is kind of a trickier person, and you return to Dylan later in the book, talking about him getting a Lifetime Achievement Award, where he, right after the Gulf War, one of the Gulf Wars anyway, he comes out and, bless his heart,
sings Masters of War in such a strange fashion. If one is a Dylan follower, Dylanite, I don't know quite what the right term is, and I should note at this point that I've gotten several disappointed responses of people who didn't recognize the book's subtitle as a reference to a Jesus Jones song, and were expecting a book about Bob Dylan. And when they discovered he came up for about two pages, they were pretty bummed, and I apologize to everyone who wanted another Bob Dylan book. I promise there'll be plenty more Bob Dylan books written by scholars over the course of the next 50 years.
So that's caveat emptor.
So Dylan comes out, he does this extraordinary thing, two extraordinary things. He plays Masters of War But as Greil Marcus said in a beautiful summary of it, he played it in disguise. You couldn't even tell what song he was. He refused to sing a melody, not that the song has a surplus of melody, but it has some. And he refused to sing it, and he sort of slurred his words. And that process of coming to know what he was even singing at all was this very interesting. It was like he was putting you through the experience of having a realization. And that's a different kind of like watching the world wake up, but not from history, into history. And then he gave this utterly nutty non-speech, non-acceptance, where he sort of talked about his daddy, but it was nonsense. He was off-quoting a passage from Psalms and sort of rambling, and mainly in a genius way succeeded in never saying thank you, which is a quite a great achievement when you're called onto the stage to take a Lifetime Achievement Award.
So it could have been a Dylan snub, and people who've been to Dylan concerts know that sometimes he snubs the whole audience when he feels like it.
I've been to enough Dylan concerts to be more confused than ever.
I'm speaking with Joshua Clover. He is Associate Professor of English Lit and Critical Theory at University of California, Davis. He's been a music critic in his life. He's a poet, a very distinguished poet who's won Best American Poetry of the Year at least three times, or at least he's been in that collection, which a great collection, lots of times. If you're interested in poetry and just want to get your feet wet, that's a good way to start, especially if you were poisoned by reading T.S. Eliot as a senior in English class in high school.
T.S. Eliot's not that bad.
There are other ways to go. So says the poet. Anyway, his book of poems, Madonna Anno Domini, has got a couple of really great poems in there that I just was able to glance at beforehand. So I recommend all that. But it's fun talking about music and politics together, which is the essence of this book, 1989. Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about. And some of it is theory, and you got to wrestle with the theory in this book. Part of it is the theory of what pop music and, I suppose, culture as a whole, or maybe not all of culture, but a lot of culture, what it can or cannot do as far as a force for political change. You appear to discount the possibility, as you put it, that pop music somehow intervenes in history, that it's a site of resistance or even of insight, of new political awareness. Why such a low view or minimal view of the role that pop music can play?
I think you're fairly enough pointing out that I may be guilty of overstatement. I'm not absolutely sure as to what powers popular culture or popular music has, but I certainly made that claim in response to what seemed to me very easy valorizations of pop music, of people saying, well, this is my form of resistance. I'm listening to such and such a song, or this song is really like politically virtuous. And at some level, If what a song does is sit on a CD that you have to pay $11.99 for, it's a download you have to pay 99 cents for, that flattens out all songs. You know, the song of political righteousness, my favorite political band right now, I would say, is a Oakland hip-hop group called The Coup. But at some point, the money you pay for their CD that goes spinning into the world global system, and the money you pay for Garth Brooks CD, it's the same money, it's the same activity. And so I want to be very skeptical about what forces those in the cultural sphere or the sphere of concepts those songs might have differently. And remember that at the level of our actual wallet experience and having to show up to work and get money to pay for crap, there are real limits to what pop culture can do.
So let's explore that just a little further. So by the virtue of you buying a CD, by the virtue of the music being in the marketplace, to put it that way, that it somehow drains that music of its political potency.
Yeah, you're asking the right questions. I don't know if it drains it of its political potency. I think that it puts a frame around its political potency. You know, I was a writer for a long time for The Village Voice, which is was for a long time a very lovely place to work, and Spin Magazine, maybe somewhat less so. It's a national glossy. It's, you know, sort of the Avis to Rolling Stones Hertz. And I came to understand after a while that no matter how much my own politics, which are, you know, leftist anarchist West Coast type, no matter how much they would inflect my reviews, those reviews would always be on a page surrounded by advertisements. They would always be selling stuff to kids. And that frame never went away. And so I had a lot of freedom in what I could say, actually, but it could never leave the frame. And in that same sense, the fact that most music exists in the market is a kind of frame that limits the possibilities. Now, obviously, I felt very politically inspired by songs at times. Moreover, sometimes you get pure energy. You're going off on a march or to engage in some kind of political action. And, you know, there's, of course, liquid courage in this world, but there's also listening to battle songs to get yourself cranked up. And I've absolutely had that experience. And in that way, they can be very effective. But I also, just to sort of finish this answer, think that when the songs really do capture a political force, it's not that they've caused it to happen, it's that they've grabbed a hold of something that's already loose in the culture, that's already on people's minds, and they've put their finger on it, which is a very powerful thing they can do. But that's different from saying that they've really brought a force into being.
Along those lines, Joshua Clover, you're right. This, the idea that pop music can intervene in history would require imagining that it retains some autonomy from the determining powers of the economy.
Sounds fancy, doesn't it?
Or from the organizing power of ideology. But that sounds like a almost like a crude deterministic sense of there's these economic forces in traditional Marxist theory, and they generate the ideas, and that, you know, ruling ideas are the ideas of the ruling class, and that's it.
Right. So I must admit that although we're all supposed to discredit that sort of model of what we call vulgar Marxism, right, I don't discredit it entirely. Now, remember, I'm talking about pop, super pop. It's perfectly possible that a song that doesn't circulate so much as a commodity, that is part of a local culture, that is shared by a living community, could be much more powerful. But the songs I'm talking about are songs that are just crushingly victorious, that have rolled through market after market, demographic after demographic. And that does tend to have a flattening effect. They're the songs that win. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard for them in that sense to register with or engage with loss and the losers of the world in certain ways. But listeners are very powerful people. Just because it's not in the song doesn't mean that you as a listener, or me or our listeners out there, can't find a way to use that song for their own purposes. And that's what I think. I think people go to songs to figure out what they want to figure out as much as what the song wants them to figure out. And that's where the power is.
Speaking with Joshua Clover, he's the author of 1989, Bob Dylan Didn't Have This to Sing About. And it's not a book about Bob Dylan, really. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to a Progressive magazine. Joshua Clover, you asked me earlier who I thought might still have a music that is confrontational or has the power to confront. And I'm not I'm kind of a musical fool, but I listen. And so, you know, Bob Marley had real politics, but now, and he's more popular now than he was when he was dead. You know, there's Springsteen, there's Ben Harper, there are people like that who are pop, pop, pop. By the nature of them getting pop, 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 does that just take away their confrontational possibilities?
Maybe so. No. The question we'd have to ask is how they became pop, pop, pop. I guess I would maybe haggle with you, although I think Bob Marley is a very interesting case, and I think it's hard for me to respond. His political valence, I think, in various kinds of struggles in Jamaica and in the West Indies are very interesting, and I don't feel qualified to have a strong opinion about them. But I think that Bob Marley's political function in the U.S. has been, and I'm going to choose my words judiciously here, disastrous.
Why?
Because it's led to a bunch of people thinking they're political when they're just smoking pot.
Hmm. Well, I hear that. We only have about 5 minutes left, and you told me when we were preparing, just sitting down here, that you've been arrested a couple times in protests against the privatization of the University of California system. Tell me about that.
It's a bit of a long story, but a familiar one. The University of California, which is by almost all accounts the top-ranked public university system in the country or the world, no offense to the mighty Badgers, has been going through difficult times, as has almost every institution and public institution in the last few years. In California, there's been a defunding of education for at least 30 years since the Reagan Revolution and the tax revolts of the late 70s. The way that started to be implemented recently in the UCs has really involved a classic sort of austerity for students and staff, while the upper administrative class has seen increasing ranks and increasing salaries. There have been increasing public-private partnerships. There's been very dubious investment deals structured around using student tuition to underwrite bonds that are used for constructing new buildings that generate profits that don't go back to students, and so on. So sometime last year, after a couple of very unfortunate decisions, including the granting of emergency powers to the president, institute furloughs and pay cuts and lay off various sort of bottom-rank staff, the lowest-paid, most vulnerable members, a bunch of organizing started happening around the UC system, particularly at UC Davis, at UC Berkeley, at UC Santa Cruz, UCLA, and eventually all across the UC system. And those actually got quite heated, saw some real confrontations, some real old-fashioned style building occupations by workers, students, staff, some faculty, and ended up with some people in and out of jail a few times.
So tell me how you got arrested.
The first time, I guess both times last fall, it involved being in buildings when the police had asked people to leave, and the people who were in the buildings decided they didn't want to, that they were, it wasn't really civil disobedience, it was just people were occupying these buildings to make use of them. One, we were having sort of free classes and educational programs and opening up a study space for students because the libraries had been shut down and so on. And the police had told us to leave repeatedly, and we decided we weren't going to, and, you know, we ended up in county.
What did they charge you with?
Refusal to disperse, criminal trespass, and a few people got, as always, they always pick a couple people and give them more serious charges so as to generate sort of more leverage in court.
And did they drop the charges then?
Almost all of them. I think there's a couple people who still have charges pending. What's more substantial is that the students, and of course I wasn't a student, it's harder for them to figure out what to do with me, but they ended up charging the students, the university, not the county, charged the students a quite extraordinary, absurd amount of money for repair and cleanup costs, which is a way of controlling them, right? Is that once you have them sort of owing this fictional $1,300, then it's a way of really sort of silencing dissent in the future because no one wants to incur that debt. No one can afford it, obviously. And so it becomes a strategy for sort of depoliticizing and silencing folks.
And these cuts in university systems, not only in California but around the country, dovetail perfectly with Republican strategies about privatizing everything. And it's not just Republicans with the whole neoliberal philosophy that private is good and public is bad. And how do we confront that?
How do we confront it? Well, the first thing we do is we say no, but I think that for me, the most important thing to articulate is to not get into a redistributive logic where you sort of say, like, well, there is some money in the state budget. Give more of it to the university and take it away from prisons, right? Or take it away, that's the classic sort of playing off, or take it away from this sector and that. I don't think that's the right thing to do. You don't say education is this very privileged thing. It's really important. We have to give money to that and take it away from there. That for me is the wrong way of confrontation. And the right way is to think of the university as one of the various staging areas for really demanding a rethinking and a restructuring of the kinds of social relations we're going to have entirely.
Yeah, we got to think of the social relations we want and then go after them. Joshua Clover, it's been a great pleasure having you in the studio.
Thank you so much.
Joshua Clover's book is 1989. Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about. You've been listening to Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.